From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Japan was golden in the 1980s, and then it became the poster child for an economy gone wrong, and China soared. Now there's a new story, maybe, emerging from Japan. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has juiced the Japanese economy, Abenomics. The stock market has surged, and there's a new buzz of nationalism. A push to rewrite Japan's pacifist constitution, to remilitarize. This hour on Point, Japan looks for a new start. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you think about Japan's fall, a Japanese comeback, Japanese gunboats? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us first today from Tokyo is Jacob Schlesinger, Wall Street Journal Japan's editor-in-chief. Jacob Schlesinger, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, sure, Tom, my pleasure.
Can you explain to us what just happened at the polls?
Well, Japan had elections, national elections on Sunday, and the ruling party, as you mentioned, led by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, won a very big victory. They took control of one of Japan's two houses of parliament in partnership with a smaller coalition party. And for Japan, that's a big deal because if anything, if Japan's politics has been known by anything for the outside world, it's been a series of weakness and division and inability to get anything done. With this election, for the first time in a while, you actually have a government that has the popularity and the power to get done, to move through with its agenda.
Let's look at what that might be. Here's Shinzo Abe on Sunday talking about the support he got from the Japanese people, interpreted here by Reuters.
We received overwhelming support from the people for our policies of improving the economy and solid and stable politics. We are going to continue moving forward with our brand of politics.
His brand of politics. This is not the first time he's been in the prime minister's chair. Tell us about that, Jacob.
He was prime minister once before for exactly 1 year. So in his previous incarnation, he was representative of all too many Japanese prime ministers in recent years. He took office in September 2006. Within a few months, under his leadership, his party lost one of these elections big. A lot of his aides were involved in scandal. He had poor health and he was gone. But in his time in the wilderness, he vowed to come back. He decided to become more disciplined and to focus on an agenda that was much more focused on the economy. And that seems to have been very successful, not only in getting him reelected, but in helping win a second election that has solidified his power.
He's famous in Japanese political circles as a nationalist. That was part of what got him booted out last time, focusing on nationalist issues rather than the economy. What did he look at that a lot of Japanese were not interested last time, that had him sort of, I guess his post-game was that he took the eye off the ball?
Right. I mean, I nationalism is a funny animal in Japan, and I think it's hard sometimes for Americans to understand the distinction. I mean, in Japan, in contrast with America and really most other countries, the defeat in World War II was such a searing experience that, things that we as Americans would consider to be basic expressions of patriotism or fundamental pledges of allegiance, I think Japanese have been embarrassed by, and it's been difficult to have any public expression of that. Abe is part of a group of Japanese who feel like that Japan needs to reassert its self-confidence and its self-control. But as you say, I think that turned a lot of people off, partly because of a long, deep-seated post-war pacifist tradition, and also partly because a lot of people felt, this economy has now been in two decades of decline, and really that's a much more important issue right now for a leader to focus on. So this time around, he hasn't totally shed the things that he focused on the last time, but he has taken a much bigger interest in the economy, and that's a lot of why he's been more popular and why his party has won two elections in a row now.
He has talked about remilitarization and changing the Japanese constitution. The Americans, of course, had a big role in drafting that constitution. What have its constraints on Japanese military power been, Jacob?
It's interesting. So as you say, the United States defeated Japan in World War II, and in the immediate aftermath of the war, there was a very utopian, idealistic view that Japan was going to be this model of pacifism and to create a new world that wars did not exist in, or take the lead as an example in that. And so the early constitution basically forbade Japan from even having an army. Quickly after that, the United States pivoted from World War II to the Cold War. Asia, of course, was a crucial front in that, particularly the Korean War. So fairly early on, the United States reversed course and tried to encourage Japan to militarize, but in ways that the U.S. had controlled. But it's been an ongoing tension in Japan for much of the post-war period. So that's the tension that has existed, but I think partly because the U.S. is now, at least in the eyes of some people in Japan, possibly pulling back in Asia, because China is now rising in a way that it had not before, and because I think there is a feeling, a lot of people in Japan politically, that you know the World War II is now well past us, that it's time to move on, and that Japan should have a military with the rights of any other nation.
With the implications, all the implications of that in a region where there's been new tension with China's rise. And Abenomics, the main elements of that, there's been a lot of excitement about it, even though Japan's economy is still far from robustly healthy.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. But, you know, and actually, in a lot of ways, they are the two, the issue of nationalism and the economy are not entirely separate. But I think that Japan's slide in its economy has also had a feeling of a wounded national pride. You know, 2 years ago, China passed Japan as the world's second largest economy, and that did not go unnoticed in Japan. And I think, interestingly, Abe, although he doesn't say it so explicitly, I think part of his view is that a strong economy is a prerequisite for Japan to be able to stand its ground. And so the two are related in some way. You're right that Japan still has a long way to go to repair its economy, but it's doing a lot better, at least on the surface, than it was just 6 or 7 months ago. So there's early signs of success, at least certainly measured by the stock market here.
But the stock market, what? It was way up. It's drooped some. Where does it stand now?
You know, it's still 40% up since the beginning of the year, which by global standards is pretty good.
Yeah.
It's not 80% up. But, you know, we at the Wall Street Journal, you know, and others, we define a bear market is when you drop 20% from its peak. And you know, after becoming a bull market, it became a bear market fairly quickly in mid-June. But, you know, we're now on the cusp, probably will in the next couple of days, be 20% up from the trough and be back in another bull market. So I think there's a feeling that at least for now, Japan's stock market is pretty stable and one of the best performing in the world.
Though up 40, down 20, you got some volatile numbers there.
Depends on your basis. It's definitely one of those volatile in the world as well, which I think has a lot of investors, both domestically and globally, a little nervous.
Jacob Schlesinger, Editor-in-Chief of Wall Street Journal Japan, thank you very much for being with us from Tokyo.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Let's dive on in. Mike Mochizuki joins me now from Bethesda, Maryland. He's professor of political science, international affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Mike Mochizuki, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
And from Washington, Yuki Tatsumi, senior associate of the East Asia Program at the Stimson Center Policy Think Tank. Yuki Tatsumi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show, Tom.
Yuki, what's the signal of Japan to itself, of Japan to the rest of the world in this big endorsement of Shinzo Abe, Abenomics, and maybe a little bit of nationalism in there too? What's Japan saying?
I think Japanese voters was saying at Sunday's election that they really want their economy to back on track. And that's why they gave this big, big victory to Mr. Abe and his government. Public, though, is very, very uncertain, less than lukewarm about what you described as a nationalistic policy agenda that Mr. Abe supports. So I think for this election, if you ask me one takeaway would be really, Japanese people want their economy back on track, and that's what they expect most out of Mr. Abe.
They had such a great economy, it fell so low, years and years and years of deflation, that's hard to take. Mike Mochizuki, at the same time, they've seen China's rise right in their backyard, sometimes a pretty feisty China. It's not hard to imagine why some Japanese would say, we've got to have a stronger military here with this big rising, really superpower right in their backyard.
Yes, that's correct. There's no question that the Japanese people are very concerned about the rise of Chinese military power. They're also concerned about increasing Chinese assertiveness, especially regarding the territorial disputes that Japan has with China over the Senkaku Islands, known in Chinese as the Diaoyu Islands. And so because of that, the Japanese want to beef up their defense capabilities and to strengthen the U.S.-Japan alliance. But at the same time, they're caught in a real strategic dilemma because the number one trading partner for Japan is China. China's growing market has been the economic lifeline for Japan for the last 5 years or so. Although the Chinese economy is not growing as briskly as before, there's no question that Japan needs the Chinese economy. And so Prime Minister Abe is going to face this dilemma of on the one hand, being firm towards the Chinese regarding the military assertiveness, but on the other hand, making sure that the relationship with China is stable enough so that the trading relationship and the investment relationship can continue.
Yuki, has Japan figured out how to prosper and feel secure in a time when China is taking a lot of manufacturing and looming so large right next door?
I think that's the dilemma, as Mike rightly put it, is in for the last decade or so. As Jacob said, in Japan, nationalism is a really, really funny thing that what you actually see if you talk to, you know, Japanese, like average Japanese on the street, what you see is not really nationalism in the sense that going back to 1930s, the glorification of the military. Mm-hmm. But they still just want to love their country. They want to be proud. They want to be self-confident.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a struggling Japan between the U.S. and China trying to find its way back. Economic revival, remilitarization, maybe throw out its peace constitution post-World War II, practically U.S. written. Very interesting moment for Japan. Mike Mochizuki joins us from George Washington University. Yuki Tatsumi from the Stimson Center joins us from Washington. Yuki Tatsumi, can you explain to us just for a minute here the literal constraints on Japanese military development that are imposed by this post-World War II constitution? What's it say? What's it allow? What does it not allow? What are people talking about changing?
So basically, the current constitution, of course, Mike can add it on later on,
sure.
But current constitution, the focus of the debate on this is Article 9, the particular article that forbids Japan to own any type of a military force. And then also, they also prohibits Japan of the right of belligerency, basically the right to declare war.
So of defense only.
Defense only, strictly defense only. And that's the basic principle that the Japan built up its military on. And it kind of get into a very detailed discussion of there are two types of self-defense in the constitutional debate, which is individual right of self-defense, which is country's own right to defend itself when someone tries to invade you. Mm-hmm. And there's a right of a collective self-defense where your friends or your allies basically attack for one is attack for all kind of logic.
Mm-hmm.
So Japan's current interpretation of the Constitution of Article 9 is Japan has a right to individual right of self-defense, which is I defend for myself, I defend for my territory. But it is prohibited to exercise the latter half, which is, you know, attack for one is attack for all types of self-defense.
So hypothetically prohibited from working with the United States as an ally militarily in some circumstances. Is that what that means?
In some circumstances, that's exactly what that means. And then also, if you think about peacekeeping operations, for example, not everywhere is safe, even if you go there for ceasefire monitoring. Japan's self-defense force has its contingents going patrolling. They see their fellow PKO troops from other country either about to be attacked or being under attacked.
Yeah.
In any other country's military, it can come to that particular military that's under attack's defense. In Japan's case, however, it has to wait until one of their men gets shot at or they're threatened to get there. So it really actually puts the tremendous constraint on what Japan can do on the effort for peace and stability on a global size, global operations.
Mike Mochizuki, we're going to talk more about the economy in just a moment. Hugh Patrick will join us. But on this military side, I mean, this is such a sensitive issue. And so many in Japan, I spent 5 years there. I know how devoted many people were to this peace constitution and are. Is the talk about some constitutional change that would allow more running room for the military, is it about pride or is it about practicality? And talk about that, if you would, in the context of rising China next door.
Yes. Well, first of all, it's important to distinguish between reinterpreting the Constitution, which can be done by a decision of the cabinet, and formal revision of the Constitution, which is a much more difficult process.
Yes.
It requires a two-thirds majority of both houses of parliament, and then a vote by a national referendum, and the majority of the voters would have to vote for it. And so in the immediate future, I think the focus of the Abe government will be reinterpreting the Constitution to address the issue that you could just mention, which is to enable Japan to exercise the right of collective self-defense. Since 1954, the government has had this interpretation that under international law, Japan has the right of both individual and collective self-defense, but because of the Constitution, they cannot exercise the right of collective self-defense.
How does this practically come into play as Japan watches China grow and invest a lot in its military? What's its practical concern?
Right. Well, in terms of dealing with China, if it's an issue of individual self-defense, I don't think it really matters. But it matters for other kinds of contingencies, as Yuki has pointed out. One is in terms of dealing with peacekeeping operations. Another is the ability to shoot down a ballistic missile that might be fired from North Korea that's headed out to the United States. And some have raised questions that Japan could not do that under the current interpretation of the Constitution. And if Japan did not do that, that would really undermine the U.S.-Japan alliance. It may also affect the Taiwan contingency. You know, let's say China attacks Taiwan. The United States wants help from Japan to then counter Chinese aggression. Well, as long as China does not directly threaten Japanese territory, then some might argue that the current interpretation of the Constitution would prohibit that kind of action. And so it's in those cases, those concrete cases, that this debate about reinterpreting the Constitution becomes salient. But if China were to threaten Japan directly, even under the current interpretation of the Constitution, the Japanese could defend itself.
How hard do you think Yuki Tatsumi, Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister, will push to change or reinterpret the Constitution on this front, the military?
I think it is easier for Abe to push a reinterpretation of the Constitution because there's that kind of a very specific practicality issue that he can articulate of why his government wants to do it. But moving on to revising the actual Article 9 will be a lot harder. As you said, as you and Mike mentioned, Article 9 is very much part of the Japan's self-identity in the post-war era as a peaceful nation. And touching that is a very, very, not only politically sensitive, but divisive issue. And public, frankly, doesn't want to go there at this moment. And that is why you might note that in the Jacob's earlier report from Tokyo, mm-hmm. when Abe spoke about, you know, what his priorities are, what his party's mandates are, he deliberately did not mention constitutional revision in his own remarks. He only mentioned about economic reform and the reinstituting a self-confidence in Japan.
He says he has learned from previous defeats after he talked more about that kind of quote-unquote nationalist move.
Precisely. So he is definitely more responsive to public's voices. And frankly, it will be politically hard. Even with this big victory in the upper house election this Sunday, this result will still not give him the votes he would need to push for the types of constitutional revision that he might be interested in having.
And even with the rising tension with China that we've seen in recent years over islands and more. Yuki Tatsumi, it's great to have you here. Mike Mochizuki, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from New York, Hugh Patrick, founder and director of the Center on Japanese Economy and Business at Columbia Business School, author of Reviving Japan's Economy. Hugh Patrick, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Could you describe for us just how long and bad Japan's economic swoon has been? I think even now a lot of Americans haven't taken on board just how rough it's been, the deflation, the whole works, Hugh.
Frankly, I think we're probably exaggerating the extent of the swoon. The reality is that after growing very fast from the early 90s on to now, the economy has been essentially flat. It has not declined. There has been slow growth, but it's been very volatile and erratic and overall a very mediocre economic performance. So relative to our expectations that Japan would continue to do quite well given its potential, it did slide. But in absolute terms, the standard of living in Japan has gone up, has not gone down, though I think calling it flat for the last two decades is the best way of thinking about it. And much of the problem has been that domestic demand, both consumption and investment, simply hasn't grown fast enough to use the potential growth of the economy and achieve it well.
You put it in rather sanguine terms, flat growth for two decades for a country accustomed to the kind of upward joyride that Japan has. It's a pretty painful experience. We've heard many Japanese describe that. And, of course, everybody's crying out for an economic solution now. I mean, that was
exactly.
A pretty big turn of events for a country that had done so well.
It is a big turn of events, but I don't want people to think there's been an absolute decline in the standard of living or in incomes. But there is certainly a decline in a year ago, people really were very depressed about the prospects for the economy, and the economy was once again in a little recession. And it's amazing what a year makes a difference. And now there's a sense of hope, increasing confidence, so I think there still is a way to go. There's this new economic policy called Abenomics, which is being implemented or has to be implemented even more. And in a sense, this new election results provides Prime Minister Abe and the government an opportunity to really carry out wide-ranging structural reforms. But it's also a challenge because that's what the Japanese people expect, as indeed my colleagues have mentioned.
Structural reforms always difficult in any economy, very difficult in Japan, where there have been sort of large traditional promises to employees and to specific sectors, agriculture. What are the elements of Abenomics? We've heard a lot about this. We've seen Japan's stock market soar. What are the elements that have already been implemented? What's brought on this stock market for at times frenzy?
Yeah, I think it started actually even before the beginning of the year, even before Abe was formally, Liberal Democratic Party won December election, much
earlier
less
vote,
recent election, because people had expectations that they would finally move ahead. And in a sense, Abenomics was first of all a statement of expectations on three dimensions: monetary policy, fiscal policy, and then structural reform for growth. They've done very well on implementing monetary policy, and that happened starting in March.
Very easy money.
Extraordinarily easy money. Everybody knew that when the new governor came in to the Bank of Japan in March, very much promoted or appointed by Abe, that monetary policy would be easier. But it was even more easy than it was expected. And indeed, the Governor Kuroda has said that the Bank of Japan will continue to do whatever is necessary to end deflation, because you have two things going at once. You had sort of the flattening of the economy, which was this sort of sense of malaise that it generated. And then you had deflation. And Japan is the only major economy in the world that's had sort of a very mild but pernicious deflation for the last 15 years.
Americans Americans alive today have really never known that.
Well, you have to go way back in history, and it's so far in history that none of us remember it. Mm-hmm. So in terms of anything in the post-war period, certainly that's true.
And at this point, monetary policy, I mean, we've had very easy money in this country too, but also fiscal policy. They've been spending like crazy. What's the rationale been? The call in America is for, or has largely been for, belt tightening.
There's a big debate about having austerity or growth. And my own view is that austerity turns out to be a mistaken approach, and we see the results of that in Europe. The Japanese have said we will have austerity only after we restore good growth. And once you get back on the good growth path, it's the time to raise taxes and engage in what the Japanese call fiscal consolidation, budget reduction. And I think that's the right approach. What they did in March was also to provide further spending stimulus by a government supplementary budget, which gives a boost to the economy in the short run. And eventually they're going to have to raise taxes more and more. In fact, they already have laws about raising taxes which go into effect next spring and then the year after. Presume they can the government can decide not to implement them, but if the economy is doing well, they probably will. And so then that raises a question, well, will that dampen growth so much? And this becomes a kind of a political issue as well as an economic issue. My own solution would be to let the consumption tax, which has now already been passed, go up from 5% to 8% next spring. And if it looks like the economy is being hurt too much by that because it dampens demand, to have a supplementary budget sort of in your back pocket ready to pass to mitigate adverse effects in order to continue the growth process.
Spend and spend again. Mike Mochizuki, join us here for a minute. I mean, a big run-up in the stock market, but it is still easy to find people who are pessimistic about Japan's economic future. Rapidly aging population, national debt at 200% of GDP. That's much higher than European countries that have found themselves in trouble. Abenomics has raised a lot of excitement, but there's still deep apprehension behind that, Mike.
That's right. And so there was a recent public opinion poll that was taken right after the election, and in fact, public support for the cabinet has taken a sharp drop because the Japanese people are not sure that Abenomics is really helping them. And one of the things is that household income has really not grown. The Japanese families aren't able to save as much as before. And so this trickle-down economics hasn't really helped them at this point. And in order for Japan to really grow, as Hugh Patrick mentioned, structural reform is a big part of this. And labor productivity really has not increased. And so if Japan is going to become a more efficient economy, it's going to have a much more fluid labor market. And in order to have that, Japan is going to have to put in a much more robust social safety net. So that it doesn't hurt the lives of average people. And then it has to implement changes that will increase innovation. Now, one of the problems is that in order to get the electoral victory that Abe got, he also had to make promises and provide public spending to vested interests, especially the construction industry, mm-hmm. or also to make promises to the agricultural sector. And so although the people as a whole want the Japanese economy to become more efficient, to revitalize, and hopefully their lives would improve, that politically, Mr. Abe may have to continue to support these vested interests, which would then work against structural reform. So he's got a major challenge. You know, how to go against some of these vested interests so that he can make the economy much more efficient and eventually family incomes, household incomes, and job security increases.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a struggling Japan between the U.S. and China trying to find its way back. Economic revival, remilitarization, maybe throw out its peace constitution. Big election over the weekend puts Shinzo Abe in as prime minister again with his Abenomics juicing up the economy, but still big questions about where that's going. China as a rising power right next door, and Japan reconsidering some of the constraints on its military that came with the U.S. at the drafting pen in its constitution after World War II. Hugh Patrick joins us from New York, director of the Center on Japanese Economy and Business at the Columbia Business School. Yuki Tatsumi is with us from the Stimson Center in Washington. And Mike Mochizuki joins us. He's professor of political science and international affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs, George Washington University. Mike, lots of comments from our listeners here. Here's one from Xenia. Says, as China grows stronger and we, I guess the U.S., cut our budget, she asks, wouldn't it be in our interest for Japan to militarize? On the other hand, Ryoko Yamamoto writes, I think it's important to see Japan's militarization in a multilateral perspective. The presence of U.S. bases, U.S. geopolitics have played a critical role, Ryoko writes, in post-World War II remilitarization of Japan, will continue to do so. She says, as a citizen of Japan who grew up hearing the misery and brutality of World War II, I'm terrified by the direction the current administration, Abe, seems to be heading in. What about those two perspectives, Yuki?
I think they both are right. I mean, they just have a very different perspective, but they do have that's their view. And then I think what has not been discussed whenever we talked about nationalism in Japan is this silent majority who wants to have self-confidence in Japan, who wants Japan to have a robust military capability to defend itself, to be able to work with United States more closely, to whether to respond to regional contingencies in East Asia, or more globally with in a peacekeeping operation, that type of activities. But at the same time, they are, you know, those who are aware what Japan has done to its East Asian neighbors and during the World War II, and they are not comfortable with some of the rhetoric that some of the people who are associated with Mr. Abe's government in terms of, you know, revising the history, mm-hmm. Describe the whitewashing history. I think there are a great deal of number of those people. And then I think what Abe government needs is to create a narrative or articulate his security policy or what his national security policy agenda in a way free of those ideological concerns that some of those people have, that so that they can, you know, wholeheartedly support Mr. Abe's agenda.
Let me go to Mark in New York City. Mark, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I guess my question is about Mr. Abe's nationalism, and as your guest just explained earlier, how does he plan to mend fences with ordinary Chinese people on the issues of the Nanking Massacre and the massacres of World War II? I mean, it seems like as a Chinese-American of three generations, the Chinese people that I speak to, whenever they mention Japan, they always mention Nanking, they always mention Shanghai, mm-hmm. and they always mention the atrocities that were committed. It's like it is like the Holocaust to us, and we see Japan's militarization, and we remember 1937, and it makes us cringe.
1937, the invasion of Manchuria and the long occupation or presence of Japanese troops that followed.
Yes, it absolutely does, and it makes us concerned. And I just wondered if your guests had any comments as to how Prime Minister Abe plans on tackling that, because I know for a fact that the vast majority of Chinese people, both in China and America, I know and I've spoken to, feel the exact same way.
Mark, I really appreciate your call. High sensitivity in China, and not only China, Korea as well, of course, long occupied by Japan back in that period. Mike Mochizuki, back in Parliament some a ways back, Shinzo Abe was asked whether he would reconsider an official apology that Japan issued in 1995 for its colonization of Korea in the past century. And his response was this, and I think this goes to Mark's question about China as well. Abe said, the definition of what constitutes aggression has yet to be established in academia or in international community. Things that happen between nations will look differently depending on which side you view them from. A lot of Chinese and South Koreans cringed at that. No small number of Japanese as well. What about Abe's framing of history and his nationalist perspective, Mike?
Right. Well, that was definitely a Bill Clinton moment for Abe in terms of the issue of history. But first, I just want to take issue with the use of the term remilitarization. That's been used a lot in this conversation. And I think what Japan is trying to do is not to become a great military power like in the 1930s. Chinese and Koreans may suspect that, but even under Abe, he's under severe fiscal constraints. So even if he relaxes some of those constraints, you know, Japan's defense spending is not going to go that far beyond 1%. The caller is exactly right that the historical issue is very sensitive, and you have to kind of go back to Prime Minister Abe's political DNA. His grandfather was Nobusuke Kishi. He was Prime Minister of Japan from 1957 to 1960.
Mm-hmm.
But as well as that, he was instrumental in the colonization of Manchuria. He was the Minister of Munitions in the Tojo cabinet. And he was a suspected Class A war criminal. And
Manchuria, so, as in China.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And so given that, Mr. Abe instinctually has a different view of history than the Tokyo war crimes view of history that Japan launched this war of aggression. He sees a much more complicated history. And so that's his political DNA. But he has to understand how sensitive this issue is to the Chinese, and especially to the Koreans. And one of the things he said repeatedly is that he regretted the last time when he was prime minister that he did not make a visit to the Yasukuni Shrine, which honors the war dead of Japan.
But very controversial to many when high officials visit there, because there are also war criminals there.
Over a dozen Class A war criminals are memorialized. And there's a lot of fear, even in Japan, that Mr. Abe will follow through on the visit to the Yasukuni Shrine. And there's the possibility that he may kind of revise the so-called Murayama Statement of 1995, which gave an unequivocal apology to the world and to the Asian countries about aggression and atrocities. So Abe may instinctually want to do that, but he's got to understand that if he does that, he will not only make highly confrontational the relationship between Japan and China, but might hurt relations between Japan and South Korea even more than they are now. And this may also cause a lot of discomfort in the United States, and Abe needs a strong U.S.-Japan alliance. So I think we will soon find out whether it's going to be Abe the pragmatist or whether it's going to be Abe the nationalist. But I would strongly caution him to be very sensitive about the history issue.
Yuki Tatsumi, this can seem like ancient history, history certainly in the United States, but in Asia, where these ties and the not only security but economic implications are so great, this can seem very fresh. I mean, we've got coming up on August 4th, marks 20 years since Japan signed the Kono Statement. That was formally apologizing for Japan's use of comfort women or women forced into sex work during World War II, a lot of Koreans in particular. And in the past, Mr. Abe has cast doubt on whether those women were actually coerced, despite all the evidence out there. How do you see him looking at these different strands, national pride, nationalism, economic requirements, the sensitivity of his increasingly powerful Asian neighbors, Yuki?
I think that's where his real test is going to be moving forward, Tom, is that pragmatist side of Abe understands that Japan needs China, and Japan also needs Korea, frankly, in order to be a effective diplomatic and political country mm-hmm. in the East Asia. And that's exactly, by the way, what the United States needs Japan to be. The United States cannot have Japan have an isolating itself from its neighbors and not being able to work with them on North Korea issue and a whole host of regional issues. So real test for Mr. Abe is, as Mike pointed out, although his political DNA, because of his own upbringing, may in a sense, color his views in mm-hmm. a certain way, mm-hmm. and those are very sensitive and controversial issues, he really has to understand that, A, it really doesn't resonate with the general public in Japan. Japan does not want to see overly confrontational mm-hmm. relationship with any of its neighbors. And then I think you also have to think about the other long-serving prime minister, like Prime Minister Nakasone and Prime Minister Koizumi, and how they handled their relations. Those two leaders, they also believed in strong U.S.-Japan relations. They also advocated for robust Japanese security role. But then they also were mindful that Japan cannot have overly tense relations with Korea and China. And Prime Minister Koizumi, although he irritated Chinese and Korean government, South Korean government, by visiting Yasukuni Shrine over and over and over again, to the point where it actually irritated Japanese people too, but he also, at the same time, when he visited China, he went to Marco Polo Bridge, where Japanese aggression actually started. Mm-hmm. He toured the museum that really recorded that history of aggression that the Japanese army made during the war. And, you know, he went through the museum very carefully. And when he was asked for his comments after his visit, he said, "I visited this museum because I wanted to come here to reiterate again how Japan as a country remorses its past."
Yeah, so regret there. The weight
exactly.
of history, very large.
Exactly.
Requirements, so, very large as well. Forgive me, Yuki. I'm going to get a couple more calls, if I may. Al in Louisville, Kentucky. Al, you're on the air. Hello, Al.
Yes, I'm a first caller. I'll be brief. I'm a strong Japan as well as a strong allies, period. Yeah, I believe any functioning republic or democracy needs strong allies economically and militarily, self-sufficient so that for success.
Al, your line's breaking up, but I think I got it. Hugh Patrick. Al saying that the U.S. needs strong allies militarily and economically. I mean, in the past, it was commonplace for Americans to talk about Japan as an unsinkable aircraft carrier for the United States. Now, that's kind of, in a funny way, that's kind of could be seen as demeaning. You're just an aircraft carrier. But certainly, it's been a big ally for a long time. What's the importance of Japanese strength to the United States in a time of Chinese ascent, Hugh?
Oh, I think that the U.S.-Japan alliance is more important than it's ever been, precisely because of this new challenge of the rise of China. And the challenge is how to adjust Chinese perceptions and our perceptions, frankly, so as to accommodate it into a peaceful global political security and economic system. Mm-hmm. We've been talking a lot about tensions, political security, historical tensions, and they're very real and very important. But the big positive is that the economic relationships between the United States and Japan is just absolutely fundamental and strong and mm-hmm. taken for granted. The economic relationship between China and Japan, maybe it's good for Japan, it's even more important for China. So that I think that the sort of economic self-interest of everybody tends to sort of hold down and be a further important factor as people consider these military and security tensions that we've been talking about. And so my sense is that the economic dimensions of this are very positive for the United States and for Japan and for China too.
If I may ask you on that front, when Japan took a lot of manufacturing from the United States, the U.S. in large part evolved toward IT and high-tech, the whole digital realm. Now China, I mean, turnabout's fair play, I don't know. Now China is taking manufacturing from Japan. Is Japan ready to move to a different industrial base, post-industrial base? Can they do what Silicon Valley did, Hugh?
Well, they may not do it as well or in the same way as Silicon Valley, but certainly they are indeed having to adjust and are adjusting. Their manufacturing strengths are very real, and a lot of it is below the radar screen because they're middle-sized companies that produce very specific components or parts or things that have high market share, not just in Japan, but globally.
But they just posted a record trade deficit. Those aren't words we associate with Japan. Forgive me, our time is so short. Mike, I want to ask you just to wrap here. Lots of listeners asking about nuclear power in Japan after Fukushima. Of course, the news that's just come out that the Tokyo Electric Power Company that runs it has admitted for the first time that those reactors are leaking highly contaminated radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. What about Japan's nuclear dependence post-Fukushima as Abenomics tries to gear up, Mike? Does nuclear come back or go away or something else?
Well, Prime Minister Abe definitely wants to get Japan's nuclear energy program back on track. But despite this electoral victory, there is still a large majority of the Japanese who would like Japan to move away from nuclear energy. So it's going to be very tough politically for Mr. Abe. And every time there are new news about leaks, radioactive waste, that's not going to help them. And so I think to some extent Japan will begin to use nuclear energy again for electricity, but it's not going to get back to where it was before the Fukushima tsunami incident.
And of course, the Fukushima story itself, the situation itself, still not under control all this time after the tsunami knocked it over, put it out of commission, and everything else we've seen with the damage that resulted there. I want to thank all three of you for being with us this hour. Just terrific. Hugh Patrick at Columbia Business School, thank you very much for joining us, Hugh.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Yuki Tatsumi at the Stimson Center in Washington, thank you, Yuki.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And Mike Mochizuki at George Washington University, thank you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.